And I don't think history of philosophy makes people especially contrarian, where you just read the ancients, and they were, like, they were just remarkably, they were impressive for their time, right? You know, they had much less knowledge than we have today, right? So, you know, they weren't, like, dumb people. But they just, you compare the quality of the ancients doing philosophy to the quality of moderns doing philosophy, and the moderns totally blow the ancients out of the water. And I don't think history of philosophy makes people especially contrarian, where you just read the ancients, and they were, like, they were just remarkably, they were impressive for their time, right? You know, they had much less knowledge than we have today, right? So, you know, they weren't, like, dumb people. But they just, you compare the quality of the ancients doing philosophy to the quality of moderns doing philosophy, and the moderns totally blow the ancients out of the water.
Hi, welcome. This is the From the New World podcast. Today I'm speaking with Matt Adelstein, the author of the Bentham's Bulldog newsletter. I think there's been a lot of developments recently around effective altruism, and there's been an extreme focus around AI specifically. We wanted to take a step back from that, talk about some of the other issues EA has to offer, and I think Matt is a great guest to do exactly that. We start with things that are more specific, more kind of mainstream EA, animal welfare specifically, and why people want to ban lab-grown meat. But we also get into more probabilistic arguments for God, the case against romantic philosophy, and Matt's broader experience with applying more analytic philosophy-style thinking to the issues of everyday life. I think that this is a thoroughly enjoyable episode. It certainly was for me. Hopefully it'll be the same for you. And if it is, then the best thing you can do to help us out is to let a friend know, either in person or online. And, of course, if you like Matt or want to hear more of what he has to say or write, then you can find him at benthams.substack.com, and that link will be below as well. Without further ado, here's Matt Adelstein.
Why are people banning lab-grown meats? What is with this?
Well, I mean, so if you want the, like, psychological account of why people are banning lab-grown meat...
Sure, sure.
I mean, I think it's for, like, weird culture war reasons where lab-grown meat is associated... Like, literally the extent of it is, like, lab-grown meat is associated with globalists and Bill Gates, and people on the right don't like those folks, and so as a result, they support banning it. But in terms of the normative question of whether we should ban lab-grown meat, well, so sometimes we should ban things that are bad. You know, we should ban murder, for instance. Sometimes we shouldn't ban things that are bad, things that are sort of like a little bit bad, but, you know, it doesn't make sense to ban. But here's one thing that we should never ban: things that are good. And lab-grown meat is good, given that basically, you know, it sort of offers, you know, modest improvements in terms of health, in terms of the environment, and most importantly, it offers very significant improvements in terms of animal welfare. So, you know, right now in the United States, about 10 billion animals live in really horrifying, squalid conditions. Most of them are chickens living their entire lives in these tiny cages where they have no ability to turn around, where they have their beaks cut off with no anesthetic, where, you know, the entire floor of the shed is coated with ammonia, which is one of the foulest smelling substances. And so all of this is the type of thing where, you know, if a person inflicted it upon a dog, we would have no hesitation calling it torture. And this happens to about 10 billion beings, causing plausibly, you know, quite a bit more suffering than almost any other thing that is happening in the United States. I think more than any other thing that's happening in the United States. And so, you know, given that this is happening and given that lab-grown meat has the potential to alleviate some of it, you know, seems like a good thing, especially because, you know, we should just have a default against banning things. And the fact that, you know, something is associated with, you know, Bill Gates is not, that is not a good enough reason to ban it.
Yeah. It's this strange, I think of it less of a kind of personality thing and more of a kind of like, it's weird because it's also like associated with Singapore, right? Which is based in good, and like heredity pilled. So it's kind of confusing. Maybe the conservatives don't know about that. Maybe they don't know that Singapore is like very pro lab-grown meats. like the Singaporean government. Anyways, yeah, on the kind of broader case, it's interesting because on a meta level, I think people probably worry too much about suffering in general. But if you do worry about suffering, I think it's like probably like underrated to worry about animal suffering. I kind of have the Richard Hanani position. Do you know like Richard's position on this?
Yeah.
That like it's probably bad, but like it's hard to care enough.
Well, I don't think that's a particularly accurate representation of Hanani's position. I mean, his position is he doesn't care enough that he personally is willing to endure significant sacrifices. But I mean, yeah. I think he, you know, that's true of a lot of moral issues where like Richard would not endure significant personal sacrifices, even if he thought there was a strong moral reason to do it. Like, I don't think Richard's the type of guy to like donate a lot to, you know, an anti-wokeness charity or whatever, even though he presumably, you know, would be, I mean, he might do it for sort of the lulz, but I don't think he'd do it just because, you know, because of its negative effect on wokeness. But no, I mean, I think Richard thinks that factory farming is quite bad. And I think, you know, the case for factory farming being quite bad, you know, is pretty straightforward. It's pretty simple. It doesn't really require any controversial ethical premises. It's just like, you know, pain and suffering, they're a bad thing. We sort of accept this in normal contexts. We think, for instance, you know, if you see a dog with a thorn in its paw that produces pain every time it walks, we think, you know, that's sort of a bad state of affairs. And then the fact that basically you have an industry that causes more suffering every few years than humans have ever experienced in the history of the world, by basically keeping worldwide about, you know, 80 billion beings in these horrifying squalid conditions where they can't turn around, where they're mutilated, where they're living in feces all the time, where they never get to experience anything that's remotely enjoyable. You know, if you think that pain and suffering are bad things, then this happening to about 10 billion beings, that's significantly bad. Now, lots of people think, well, you know, okay, maybe human suffering is bad, but animal suffering, that's sort of not very important.
Yeah, a lot of people, yeah.
And, well, so, I mean, there are a few points. The first one is that even if you think it's way less important than human suffering, like orders of magnitude less, it still turns out to be one of the worst things in the world. So, for instance, you know, about 92.2 billion animals are killed each year. Maybe 80 billion of those are factory farmed. At any given moment, about 8 billion animals are in factory farms. So then imagine, okay, and it seems like based on our best estimates, it seems like animals feel pain and suffering, according to the most up-to-date report on this, at least most of the ones we factory farm, if you just take a chicken, about a third as intensely as humans. So that means that basically like the total amount of pain and suffering that's being caused is about the amount of pain and suffering that would be caused if you walked around 2,600,000 people in a cage and like tortured them for their entire life. So now you say, okay, maybe it's only 1% as bad as that. Okay, only 1% bad as torturing nearly 3 billion people. Well, okay, so that's about as bad as if at every given moment we were torturing 30 million people, and if, you know, many more than that were killed every year. If it's only 1,000th as bad, then it's only as bad as if we were torturing 3 million people at every moment. But, you know, unless you have a view that basically their pain and suffering doesn't matter at all, you get the result that that it ends up being one of the worst things in the world. And then the second point is, I don't really understand what the reason is to think that their pain and suffering isn't very important, because, you know, there are lots of ways in which, to the extent that a being isn't very smart, in which it seems they matter less, right? So, you know, it seems like that decreases their capacity for certain types of welfare. It makes it so that, you know, if I could save a chicken or a human, I'd obviously save the chicken. But just if we think about the badness of pain doesn't seem to have anything to do with whether or not one is very smart. So, you know, if you became very stupid and then got tortured, that would not make your torture any less bad. Or at least it wouldn't make it thousands of times less bad, assuming you experienced the torture just as intensely. We don't ordinarily think that, you know, a way to avoid the badness of torture is to basically like get lobotomized so that you become very dumb, and so then you it stops being bad. Like, it just seems like that the badness of Quentin's pain has nothing to do with how smart they are. And so as a result, I think that factory farming is much worse. It is, you know, about as bad as if every moment of every day, you know, many billion humans were being tortured. And it may seem extreme to call it torture, but again, if any person did this to a dog, if any person did this to a human, no one would hesitate to call this torture. If a person locked a dog in a tiny cage, lopped off its nose, forced it to live in sort of feces, made it chronically sleep deprived, made it be standing on wire meshing all the time so it could never sit comfortably, such that 90% of the dogs got foot injuries that they were keeping, you know, we would all agree that that sort of counts as torture.
Yeah, I think the refusal to kind of look at things directly is like, it's a kind of like psychological that diversion, right? I think that it's pretty clear that, you know, like if you take those premises, if you're concerned about suffering, if you're concerned about animal suffering to some fraction, then like the entire argument follows. And kind of like saying that, you know, factory farms aren't as bad as you think, those kinds of arguments seem sort of beside the point to me. Looking at this kind of utilitarian argument, like on like the aggregate of suffering, I don't know, maybe it like almost pushes me in the other direction. Maybe that's not very epistemically rigorous, but the way I think about it is that there's, I care about a lot of things other than suffering, and from my perspective, like people, even just looking at the human perspective, like people care too much about human suffering relative like to other things, right? Knowledge, kind of civilizational development. I think that there's kind of inherent good in this kind of ability to investigate the world that probably outweighs even like most human suffering in my mind. But you're right. This is the thing that like kind of makes me reconsider. You're right in that, you know, it's probably wrong just to have that be always superior to other concerns, right? That the level of suffering should compare to that, and like particularly the level of animal suffering should compare to that if there is enough of it, right? You can always give the argument like, oh, what if it were like a billion times worse than that? You know, would you care about it then? And there's some point in that line where I think I should care about it, right? But my intuition is just that like in the current world, there's a lot of people who care about suffering, maybe not about animal suffering. That's the strange thing, but like who care about suffering to an extent that is like that is in the wrong direction, at least practically for me.
Yeah, so it might be that various people care too much about suffering, and that, you know, they should care a little bit less about suffering. But just any remotely plausible view will hold, not necessarily that suffering is the only bad thing, but that suffering is at least an example of a bad thing, and that suffering in sufficient quantities of the type that's dispensed by the factory farms ends up becoming a very serious problem, right? So, you know, just imagine, like, okay, imagine if we took every, you know, there were, like, 90 billion severely mentally enfeebled people whose cognitive capacities were roughly on the level of animals. And we basically locked them in cages and then tortured them for their entire lives in very similar conditions to the ones in which animals are treated. You know, they were forced to stand on metal meshing all the time. They sort of couldn't turn around. They were, you know, in these dark sheds, covered with feces, and, you know, they have the acidic feces that, you know, burned their legs all the time. Like, okay, maybe, you know, maybe you say, okay, you know, this sucks, but like the badness of this is outweighed by the goodness of civilizational exploration or whatever, but it's at least obvious that this would be really bad. And so, and that's just, you know, that's the extent of my claim, that what we are doing to animals is really, really bad. You know, okay, maybe there are certain goods that outweigh it. You know, you don't have to think that suffering is the only thing, but just suffering on any plausible view is going to be one example of a significantly bad thing, at least in sufficient quantities. And the factory farm suffering is so great that that you know, it reaches those sufficient quantities to end up being quite morally significant.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that I think, right, it kind of ties into the lab-grown meat bans that, like, there's a lot of takes on this issue that are kind of proxy takes for other things, right, in both directions, where, especially looking at human suffering, there's a lot of political movements that claim to address human suffering that do not do it particularly effectively, or that are oriented really like pretty overtly on the kind of destruction of people who are not suffering, right? This kind of like egalitarian impulse of leveling, and then and also like don't really care that much about animal suffering, like who really should be able to make the bridge to that issue and have ways of doing it, who have ways of kind of achieving their goals in much more like obvious and non-destructive methods, but maybe the destruction is the point. And then on the other side, you know, the attempts to ban lab-grown meat are this sort of like, it's almost this kind of like Nietzschean virtue signaling, where like the idea is that, you know, if you're strong, then you'll ban lab-grown meat, you'll oppose you'll oppose the soy jacks. But like there's no actual indicator that like banning lab-grown meat is gonna like make your country stronger and, you know, more Nietzschean. I just don't see the kind of policy goal there.
Yeah, I mean, the lab-grown meat ban position, it's an interesting position because it's one of the few political positions where there are literally no arguments for it. Okay, fine, there's one. They say that lab-grown meat is bad for the environment, which is, you know, it's true about the current iterations of lab-grown meat, but it's like...
Oh, interesting.
But it's like, you know, by the time lab-grown meat becomes, you know, more readily available, like, to the extent it does become readily available on the market, it'll be like, you know, by that time it'll...
Yeah, it's a kind of Chernobyl effect where people fixate on the, like, the old version of things.
Right, yeah. And, like, if you just look at projections of, like, you know, if you track the trend in terms of how much better it's gotten for the environment and you extrapolate that out, it'll, like, you know, it'll be much better for the environment. Okay, so they have one terrible argument. But, I mean, pretty much all of it, all the opposition, all the support for banning lab-grown meat is just born out of this sort of weird kind of, like, spite where they just, like, they don't like sort of, like, vegans or, like, left-wing people who are concerned about animals or the environment who, you know, think meat is bad, and they associate it with this sort of ring of globalists who are concerned about the environment. And so as a result, they oppose it. But, I mean, really, if you just, like, if you look at what the things that people say on the topic to justify banning it, I mean, really, it amounts to a little bit more than... I mean, it's almost like Pavlovian, where they'll just sort of like say a word that gets an applause line. I mean, you know, look at DeSantis's speech where he was explaining his position to ban lab-grown meat. And they said, you know, we're going to ban lab-grown meat. You have to have your meats. It's like, what? That's not a reason to ban lab-grown meat. You know, but I mean, yeah, it's very ridiculous.
Yeah. And there is, I mean, this critique, I think, is less fair with DeSantis, but I think it's true of a lot of people supporting this, is that there is sort of evidently more effective policies if you want to like oppose leftism in a kind of effective way, some sort of effective conservatism, and this really isn't it. It's kind of, yeah, it's this kind of like shotgun approach that ends up catching a lot of like, you know, basically civilian fire, right? That ends up like lashing out in very confused, uncertain ways, where, like I said, there's no cause and effect here. Well, what is this supposed to do? What is this ban supposed to like practically do? Is like Bill Gates gonna be sad and, you know, decide not to do other, you know, culturally left wing things because, you know, this just like really got him so bad, like. It's just nonsensical. So yeah, this is for all of you Republican legislators still listening, please stop doing this. This is not well, what is your goal here? There's no reason to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, many Republican legislators also read my blog, and they should stop as well.
Yeah, the Bentham's... how is Bentham's Bulldog doing?
Oh, yeah, it's doing well, you know. I mean, it's sort of fun to write.
Great.
I'll sort of oscillate between writing about, like, topics of general interest, where, like, you know, I'll write sort of an article that people like about, the wrongness of eating meat or something, or like a link post or like a rant about Camus or something. And then I'll also just like have a bunch of articles that are these like really boring niche ones about like the self-indication assumption that no one cares about. But
yeah, I see 0 likes, 16 comments on this. Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you just know, you know, if it's an article on Anthropics, you know, no one likes articles on Anthropics. But
let me just go and give this its first like.
Wow.
Because I'm curious about this stuff. I kind of feel like too uninformed to like comment on it effectively. But let's start with what is Anthropics? Is it the study of, you know, Anthropic, the company?
No. So Anthropics is how to reason about your own existence. So and when you say that, people sort of associate it with sort of like continental philosophy, like, you know, oh, what is the nature of existence? But it's much more like sort of like technical probabilistic questions. So, you know, here's a famous example of a question. Let me give you the two most famous Anthropic puzzles. The first one's called the Sleeping Beauty problem. So a fair coin is flipped. If the coin comes up heads, you'll be woken up once. You're put to sleep. If it's flipped, you'll be woken up once. If it comes up tails, you'll be woken up once, then you'll be put back to sleep, and you'll be woken up a second time. Okay, after waking up, what should be your credence that the coin came up heads?
Okay.
I left out an important detail. Wake up relatively recently. So, you know, if it comes up tails, you're woken up, you're put back to sleep, then your memory's erased, and then you're woken up again. So you don't have a memory of the...
Right.
The previous week.
So yeah, you're given this piece of information that you've, like, woken up, and you this could be experienced twice. The idea is that this is experienced twice, and both of them are, like, fresh experiences. If it's tails, and it's only experienced once if your heads, right? Yeah. Am I getting this right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, my intuitive response is that it's like there's a 2/3 chance that that it's tails, and then a 1/3 chance that it's heads.
Yeah, I agree with that. But so there, the two common answers are a half and a third, where what the halfers say is, look, if the odds of the outcome of a fair coin should be 50-50. And then upon waking up, you don't learn anything new. You already knew you were going to wake up. And so you start out 50-50 and you learn nothing new. My view is you actually do learn something new, where what you learn that's new is not that you wake up at least once, but that you're awake at the current moment. Now, the current moment, it might be the first day, or it might be the second day. And so then, given that it might be the second day, and if it's the second day, that would rule out the coin having come up tails, or coming up heads, then you get evidence for tails. So that's why I disagree with the half-er argument. And then, yeah, so this is like the most famous problem in Anthropics. And there's no agreement about this. And so the view of Anthropics that I endorse is called the self-indication assumption. The idea of the self-indication assumption is, given that you exist, you should think that there are more people in situations that are epistemically like yours. Okay, so given that, so in the Sleeping Beauty problem, people who adopt the self-indication assumption say that you should think the coin came up tails because that predicts twice as many people in a situation that's epistemically indistinguishable from yours, where based on your current evidence, you don't know if you're in it, right? So you don't know if you're on the first day or the second day. Why think this? Well, there are quite a few arguments, but one that I find convincing is just, look, if there are more people, the odds I would be one of them is higher. Just like if there are more, you know, grains of rice, the odds that any particular grain of rice would exist would be higher. And so now, okay, you know, this ends up, you know, it's sort of, it's easy to say, but getting into the details ends up getting a little bit tricky. But this basic line I find convincing. And then the second argument for the self-indication assumption that I find convincing maybe I should just explain the self-indication assumption a little bit more. Yeah, so it says that you should think that there are more people in situations epistemically indistinguishable from yours. So here's a famous case that people give as a counterexample to the self-indication assumption. They say, okay, you know, you wake up. The self-indication assumption says you should think the universe is definitely infinite in size, because if the universe is infinite in size, there are infinitely more people like me. And so as a result, just you don't have to go out, you don't have to do any physics, you can just know the universe is infinite in size from the fact that you exist. People say, this is so weird and crazy. I accept it. I don't find it to be weird and crazy. I think it's true. And I don't find it to be that counterintuitive, given that I think you can show, like, the thing that's weird is that you can get such strong results from just reasoning about your own existence. But you can show that any view of anthropics will be able to get really strong results from reasoning about your existence in other directions.
Right. So what's interesting here is that the reason the original problem is maybe still debated is that there's a question about homogeneity there, right? That there's a question, if you assume that, you know, all three possible instances of waking up are kind of truly homogeneous and like indistinguishable from each other, then two-thirds would be just kind of objectively correct, right? But that assumption is not actually obvious.
Well, no, I mean, so I think even if the situations, the experiences were exactly the same, I think a lot of people still think that two-thirds is incorrect, because they think, you know, they just buy this half a reasoning that you didn't learn anything new, and if you don't learn anything new, you should remain with your previous guess of 50-50.
Wait, but you did learn something new, right?
I agree that you learned something new, but I'm just saying that it's not, the locus of the disagreement isn't about whether or not the experience is the same on across the days. The locus of the disagreement is about something like whether you learn something new. You know, different people have different intuitions about the case. But I don't know. So, like, here's an argument for the self-indication assumption that I find convincing. Okay, so imagine that there are two people, and they don't know when they were born. Okay, you know, and so, you know, they're just sort of sitting around and they think, okay, you know, there are two possibilities. Possibility one is that the first two people, whenever they existed, maybe it's now, maybe it's later, that they had a bunch of offspring. And the second possibility is that they didn't have any offspring, and that, in fact, we are the first two people, and that, you know, there will be no, the first two people had no offspring. And so they reason, okay, we have no idea if we're the first two people, you know, but the theory that there are more people predicts that, you know, the first two people had a bunch of offspring, it predicts that there are more people. But we reject the self-indication assumption. So we don't think that the existence of more people is more likely. And so they think, okay, so these theories start out 50-50. And then, but they think if we find out that we're one of the first two people, we'll get really strong evidence for the hypothesis that the first two people don't have any offspring. Because if the first two people do have any offspring, conditional on that hypothesis, we could be any of the billions of people. Any of the billions of people who follow from the first two people. So that's how they reason. Then they hear a booming voice from the heavens, from God, that says, you know, you are Adam and Eve, the first two people. Well, now, you know, just being Bayesians, they update in favor of the hypothesis that the first two people don't have any offspring. So now, just from the fact that they are the first two people, they get ridiculously strong evidence that the first two people won't have any offspring. So now they're very confident that they won't have offspring. And so So now you get this very weird result where basically if the first two people, before they learned they were the first two people, thought about Anthropics for a little bit, then it would be rational to assume that the odds of them getting pregnant are basically zero. So, you know, they could, you know, now they have this very effective form of birth control where they can have sex and just there's no risk of pregnancy because, you know, they know that they won't have a bunch of offspring. And in fact, you know, if they want to get really crazy, what they can do is they can set up a process where unless just a deer dropped dead at their feet, they'll have a bunch of offspring. And so now they can be very confident that the deer will drop dead at their feet because they know it's very unlikely that they'll have a bunch of offspring. And so it's much likelier that the deer will drop dead at their feet. And I think when you see this case, it's very clear that something has gone awry in a case where you think basically like people can get the ability to make deer drop dead at their feet by agreeing to procreate unless the deer drop dead at their feet. Even if they'd thought about Anthropics before finding out that they were the first two people, they would not get these kind of weird powers. And so I think that's the argument for the self-indication assumption that I find most convincing, though. You know, there are a bunch that I like.
Right. So, what is the self-indication assumption? I'm just a bit confused here.
Oh, yeah. So the self-indication assumption, that's the theory that says that given that you exist, you should think that there are more people in existence. Okay. And specifically, what kind of more people should you think there are? Right. Like, if you exist, it doesn't seem like you should think there are, like, more insects. Because, you know, they're not you. Really, what you should think is, of the people who, based on your current evidence, you might be, you should think there are more of them. So, for example, suppose I wake up in a room and I know there are 100, and I know either, you know, a coin was flipped, and either if it came up heads, 10 rooms were created, one person each. If it came up tails, 1,000 rooms were created, one person each. It seems like, it seems like upon finding out that, on the self-indication assumption, you should think that that the 1,000 rooms came up probably, because given that you don't know which of the people you are in which room, you should update in favor of theories that predict that there are more rooms full of people who you might be.
Yeah.
That's why the self-indication assumption says that you should assign credence of 1/3 to the coin having come up tails, to coming up heads, because if it came up tails, that predicts twice as many people who, based on your current evidence, you might be.
Yeah. To me, this is actually very interesting, because it's sort of a theory of science it's a question about like how generalizable are these experimental setups, right? Where I think I definitely agree with you on the room or on the sleep thing, because those experimental setups seem very clear, but with a god, maybe it's this, that like the probabilities seem sufficiently disentangled, whereas with the scenario with like Eve and God, maybe they're just not taking like probability of B given A seriously enough, right? Like they're not taking seriously how much of an update the command from God is, right?
Well, so just imagine they know with absolute certainty now that they're one of the first two people. And so then they know, well, okay, yeah. So they know that they're one of the first two people. And they think, on hypotheses according to which the first two people will have a bunch of offspring, it's very likely that we would happen to be one of the first two people, right? We could be any of the people. And so now they're super confident against theories according to which there will be many offspring. So if God comes to them and says, okay, I'll play a game of poker against you, and basically, unless you get 10 royal flushes in a row, I'll make a bunch of offspring for you. I'll make Googleplex offspring for you. Now they can be super confident that they'll get 10 royal flushes in a row, because given that they're early, they think they get very strong evidence that they won't have many offspring. And I submit that is not how that works. Okay.
Because like them being in the scenario in the first place makes it less likely that they would be one of the offspring, right?
Well, the idea,
like the offspring aren't like talking to God. Well, like most of them, right?
Right. Yeah. So the offspring aren't talking to God. But remember, the two hypotheses that we're considering are: hypothesis one is the first two people, whenever they live, have a bunch of offspring. And the second hypothesis is the first two people, whenever they live, don't have a bunch of offspring. So Adam and Eve reason. Before they know that they're the first two people, they reason conditional on the first hypothesis that they'll have a bunch of offspring. It's very unlikely that we are the first two people, because we could be any of the people. And we have no evidence that makes it likelier that we're the first two people. In contrast, on the hypothesis that there are only two people in total, it's 100% guaranteed that we would be the first two people. And so then when they find out that they're the first two people, just by being Bayesians, they get a massive, massive, massive update in favor of theories according to which there aren't very many people, such that now they can basically make whatever they want happen by agreeing to make a bunch of offspring unless certain things happen in the world.
But the way that they get that information does not retain the original probabilities, right? So the reason why they have, like, the original probabilities are the reason why it's in favor of having a few offspring conditional on them being, the reason why it's more likely that they're the original humans if there's few offspring is, like, those two, the probabilities are given that you don't know how that information is communicated to you, right? There are worlds where, like, that's true and they just never find out, right? So the fact that they find out and you know, I would say specifically the fact that they find out by, like, being told directly by God, like should affect those probabilities.
Just imagine that they know that the first two people, whenever they live, would be told by God that they're the first two people.
Okay.
Right. So in that case, after they're told that they're the first two people, now on your view, they would get, or at least on views other than SIA, they get now this, like, really massive update in favor of theories according to which they won't have a bunch of offspring. And so now, basically, like, they can be confident in that if they play a game of poker and then God will make a bunch of offspring for them unless they get five royal flushes in a row, now they can be very confident they'll get royal flushes in a row. Now, you might think, like, this isn't so weird, right? You know, imagine I know that some event won't happen in the future. If I set up a process where, you know, unless I get a bunch of royal flushes in a row, then that event will happen in the future, then I can make it happen. But the difference is, in that case, you have actual knowledge about the future. There's something you've observed about the future, or maybe you've gotten, you know, I mean, it's hard to think about how you would get future knowledge. But, you know, there's at least some way you have future knowledge. In this case, it doesn't seem like they could have this type of future knowledge where, you know, it's not like they've observed anything about the future. So it's not clear, like, it's plausible that you can't have a reason to update purely on future evidence, right? If you haven't seen the evidence yet, you can't have a reason, like, to update. If you're not currently aware of the evidence, you can't have a reason to update on the evidence in that way. And so just from observing things about the past, it doesn't seem like where no part of the past entails this, like, mechanistic knowing of the future, it seems like they can't get knowledge of the future in this way.
Yeah, that it's just too high variance, right? And the introduction of new information, even if you're conditional, even if it's conditional on, like, God telling you, it's not necessarily conditional on, like, you playing the poker game, right? Like if you play the poker game, and if you're, like, guaranteed, if you're thinking ahead of time and you're guaranteed that you'll, like, play a poker game in which or like the original descendants will play a poker game in which God gives them a bunch of offspring unless they get this, you know, five royal flushes or so on, then it's not actually clear that the probabilities would favor them being in the timeline with little offspring.
Yeah, right? And here's one other way to say they're wrong. Imagine God, rather than just making, like, two total people, like, imagine he made two people per universe in billions of universes. And then you ask, okay, assuming all the Adam and Eve's guess that they won't have any offspring, unless that they'll get a bunch of royal flushes. How many of them will be right? And the answer is almost none of them, right? Like, it's not, you know, just the vast majority of them will be wrong about the outcome of the poker game.
So, like, what's the takeaway from this, right?
Oh, well, I find it interesting, but in terms of the, like, broad takeaway about the world, well, you should think the universe is infinitely big. That's one takeaway. And then another takeaway, and this is something that a friend of mine and I were writing a paper about, is if you think the self-indication assumption is true, you should find theism a whole lot more plausible. Because, you know, if there are... So the number of possible people was, I think, convincingly proved by David Lewis to be at least Beth 2. Theism is the belief that God exists.
Yeah, what is that? What is that number, at least?
Beth 2. So
what is Beth 2?
Yeah, so there are some infinites that are bigger than others. So the smallest infinite is called, well, Aleph 0 or Aleph null or Beth 0. And then an infinite that's bigger than that is Beth 1. And an infinite that's bigger than that is Beth 2. So, for example, the number of real numbers, which include infinite non-repeating decimals, that's only Beth 1. So the number of possible agents is at least bigger than the number of real numbers. And I actually think it's more than that. I think that basically there is not a set of all possible agents. I think it's, you know, some infinites are just too big to be part of any set. And I think it's that way.
So basically, like,
yeah, so there are a lot of possible people. And then the self-indication assumption says you should think more people exist. And in fact, it says that a theory that says that there are 10 times as many people does 10 times as well. So if there's a theory that says that there are infinite times more people, then that theory does infinite times better in terms of predicting your existence. And so then the takeaway is just, okay, so Beth 2 possible people exist. The self-indication assumption gives you reason to think that Beth 2 actual people exist. Why might it be that Beth 2 actual people exist? Well, here's one reason. You know, there's this thing that lots of people believe in, which is the existence of God. And if God exists, it's kind of plausible that he'd make all possible people. You know, the odds are, I think quite high, you know, to the extent that he can bring about all possible people, and it's a good thing to do, and he's perfectly morally good. You know, he has no reason to, like, just randomly stop at 10 billion or even Aleph null when he could create all possible people, especially if you accept, as I do, that it's good to create a person and give them a good life, that basically pronatalism is correct. So God would be the ultimate pronatalist and create every possible people or every possible person. And so that means that so from Anthropics, we know that every possible person exists. And then the probability that every possible person would exist, given theism, is much higher than given atheism, right? Like, it's very hard to tell a story on which Beth 2 people end up existing if there is no God. Even if you think there's an infinite multiverse, that won't get you Beth 2 people. That'll only get you Aleph null people. That'll only get you Aleph null people. And so, yeah, it's just, you know, it's sort of a puzzle. Like, if you are an atheist, how do you get the existence of uncountably infinite people? If theism better, like, if there's some, you know, if we're Bayesians, if there's some fact that's better explained by theism than by atheism, that's strong evidence for theism. This fact is much better explained by theism. You know, the existence of every possible person is very likely on theism and very unlikely on atheism. And so to the extent that it obtains, you get very strong evidence for theism.
Right. Why isn't this more common of a religious argument? Is it just not very convincing?
I mean, like, the common...
Like, why isn't my preacher, like, getting up and saying, there are Beth 2 people?
Yeah, I mean, so lots of people have religious convictions where they think there aren't any other beings in the universe. Maybe they think that God has sort of a special covenant with humans that doesn't apply to the aliens or whatever. Let me just first address a very common objection, where people say, you know, how could there be Beth 2 people? You know, the universe is only finite in size or infinite. That can't have Beth 2 people. Okay, the claim is that there's a vast multiverse that contains all Beth 2 people.
Yes, that was my takeaway from the argument, yeah.
Yeah, I posted this on Reddit, and lots of people was like, this is totally debunked. The universe isn't big enough to have Beth 2 people. No, I mean,
classic Reddit.
No, I mean, it was sort of funny posting on Reddit because, like, the responses were so dumb. It was kind of hilarious. But, why does your preacher not tell you about this argument? Well, I mean, one reason is, you know, it's a very new argument, sort of like I invented it, like, sometime earlier this year. And the number of people on the planet who endorse the argument is in the low, like, double digits, like 15 something.
That's pretty impressive. You already convinced 14 people. That's, you know, that's the start of something great. You have 14 disciples already.
Yeah, what? Yeah. Yeah, I heard there was this famous guy who had 12 disciples. I really, really had done.
Yeah, yeah, and I heard he exists because otherwise there wouldn't be LF2 people.
Beth 2 people.
Beth 2 people. My bad.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, it might be LF2. Actually, whether Beth 2 equals LF2, I think would be controversial. There's a big debate about something called the continuum hypothesis, which is whether Aleph.
Yes, I vaguely remember this. Yeah,
but I don't know if there's work. I don't know if there's controversy about whether Aleph 2 equals Beth 2. But yeah. So I mean, the arguments are made by like street preachers and by just like normal Christians are mostly not very good arguments. Because like I don't know, the thing that they are selecting for is like sort of like convincing a Christian congregation that their faith is already correct, or like convincing like uninformed college students who haven't thought about philosophy at all, that their view is correct. And so as a result, I actually think most of the standard arguments for the existence of God kind of suck. I think the fine tuning argument's pretty good, but I think, you know, the various cosmological arguments aren't convincing. The moral argument is totally unconvincing.
But they're, you know, they're emotionally compelling. They're maybe they're not convincing from a kind of like Bayesian or like a kind of you know, proper philosophical perspective. Speaking of things that are not convincing from a proper philosophical perspective, many such cases, I'm sure. But let's talk about continentals, and let's talk about Camus specifically. What's wrong with Camus?
Yeah. So what's wrong with Camus? What's wrong with Hitler? No.
we're already. Yeah.
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 So, I mean, the problem with Camus is he gives philosophy a bad name. Because if you read his stuff, and I haven't read that much of his stuff, to be fair, but I've talked with a lot of people who like Camus. Like, his stuff is, it's not philosophy. He doesn't give arguments for things. He's not clear or rigorous or logical of a thinker. He'll make these sort of bizarre assertions that are typical of poetry, but are not typical of philosophy. So, you know, for instance, you know, his most famous quote is, there's only one deep philosophical question, that of suicide. Number one, that's not a question. That's a word. Now, obviously, you know, that's being a little bit pedantic, but it's like, if you just compare the way Camus writes to the way that analytic philosophers write, the analytic philosophers just write, like, they actually write clearly, they'll sort of convey the things they're saying in a precise way, and it's like, really? This is the only interesting philosophical question? You think the existence of God is not an important philosophical question? You think that whether morality is objective, which moral view is correct to the extent that one of them is objective, that's not an important philosophical question, whether the way we treat animal, you know, none of this is important, but the word suicide, that's a very important question. Like, what, you know, is this guy, you know, on drugs? Like, what's going on? And it's especially bad because it gives philosophy this reputation as being a lot like the rest of the humanities, where it's just, you know, this kind of deeply unserious field where it's about kind of like being flowery and poetic and expressing your opinions on things without giving any arguments for them. So it ends up giving philosophy this bad reputation. And then the thing that And the reason why I get annoyed by this is, you know, so I'm in college, and I you spend a lot of time on a college campus around people who are really enamored with Camus. And it's very frustrating because they're sort of smug and they think they have this sort of deep hidden wisdom. And then you talk
to
them.
Gnosis.
They don't know anything. They have no deep hidden wisdom. They have shallow, unhidden absence of wisdom. And yeah, I mean, they just, you know, they have no idea what they're talking about. They, you know, couldn't philosophize their way out of a paper bag. And, you know, they don't think about things in a remotely clear or rigorous or logical way. And sort of like that's the stereotype of what philosophers are like, where if you actually look at what philosophers are like philosophers dispositionally are much more like mathematicians than like poetry professors. I don't know if
they're yes, are. I agree. Wait, is that a really common stereotype of philosophers? I don't know. I went to a school with like I went to a university with almost all like math autists and engineers. So all of the people I knew who were interested in philosophy are kind of like you. So I wasn't actually. Is this actually like a common stereotype? How widespread is the stereotype of like the philosopher as like this romantic poet?
I mean, I think it's a pretty common stereotype. Like, if you just look at who the most famous, like who the most widely known philosophers are by the general public, Camus would top the list.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, and I don't know which philosophers the public knows.
It'd be like Camus and Nietzsche and all. You know, it certainly
is. Is it not Socrates? I mean, I guess maybe that's part of the problem.
Yeah, yeah. Socrates would top the list. Yeah, well, yeah. That I mean, that's another bad thing. The ancients were garbage. They were not convincing at all. There's this really weird fixation on the ancients, where people care a lot about what the ancients thought. Where like people write papers about what. You know, I recently attended a conference or a philosophy talk that was about like what the Stoics thought about slavery, where it was like trying to piece together from these limited fragments what their views were. And it's like, I don't care what the Stoics thought about slavery.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't care what people thought 2,000 years ago about some topic that's now obvious to us today. And so, yeah, I don't like history of philosophy either. I only like modern analytic philosophy. But
so I'm of two minds of this. I probably worry a lot more than the average person about kind of these self-censorship patterns. I think that I'm a sort of soft Straussian in this way. I choose that to distinguish myself from like the hard Straussian belief. But I'll just say like what specifically I think, because I don't think it's that too hard to articulate, that there are these like, you know, semi-conscious societal patterns where certain ideas are and certain positions on ideas are considered low status, and people avoid taking those positions or you know, thinking about those ideas more generally, and this leads to a kind of societal distortion, and the societal distortion is not the same. It's not held constant. So like some of the time, you know, the distortion might be around, you know, religion, might be around the Catholic Church specifically. Some of the time might be around, you know, communism. Some of the time might be around, you know, what like the greatness of the Roman, the emperor, you know, and this, you know, at least historically varied a lot by geography as well. So you might imagine that you could go and look at some of these historical positions as an insight into where that societal process in the present is kind of censoring. But yeah, I'm not sure that I think that there's a way in which this goes too far, in which people assume that there was like one specific time, perhaps the time of Socrates, that got everything right specifically. And I think that's just pretty unlikely.
Yeah, I mean,
and you can, you know, you can people who know more about kind of Greek history than I do can say, you know, here are more specific things in which they were like kind of clearly wrong.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I'm all for kind of considering contrarian and heterodox views. And you know, in fact, I have, you know,
I've seen the 100 contrarian views. We can talk about that later.
Yeah, I even have some views that I don't state publicly because.
Oh man.
Yeah, I. Yeah, but anyways.
I, on the other hand, state all views publicly.
Yeah, I have.
They just might be less obvious that they're stated publicly than others.
But yeah, anyways. So. Yeah. So then the question is, okay. So. So, what's the reason to think that, kind of like. Reading history of philosophy will improve people's ability to kind of like think about things in a logical way, to end up, you know, forming the correct views on various kind of like contrarian topics. And I don't think history of philosophy makes people especially contrarian, where you just read the ancients and they were like, they were just remarkably they were impressive for their time, right? You know, they had much less knowledge than we have today, right? So, you know, they weren't like dumb people, but they just, you compare the quality of the ancients doing philosophy to the quality of moderns doing philosophy, and the moderns totally blow the ancients out of the water. Take Socrates, for instance. Here's an argument that Socrates unironically made. He said that if you're happy and virtuous, you'll be like exactly 720 times happier than if you're like vicious, exactly 720 times. And he had this ridiculous argument for it from, you know, the soul has three parts and each of these components will have three parts and so on and so forth. And then he said, and given that this is roughly the number of days and nights in a year, we have even more evidence for this because we'd expect the laws of nature to line up with the ethical laws. What? I mean, that's a horrible argument. And just these sort of kind of like horrible arguments are very common among the ancients. Aristotle, okay, he was a pretty significant improvement. He was much more impressive than most of the ancients. But you just read most of them, and it's like, it feels like just trying to squeeze water from a stone, where, you know, the things they're saying aren't that impressive. And to the extent that people end up affirming contrarian views because they read the ancients, I think it'll be these kind of weird, incorrect contrarian views that reflect not sort of like the correct deviations from the dominant cultural views, but instead just like going back to the like weird views that were popular among the ancients.
Are we talking about Stoicism specifically here?
I wasn't, but yeah, I mean, you know, that's a fine example. Though I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, there's something valuable about Stoicism. Like, you know, it's sort of important for people to like, rather than to sort of like try to not take their problems too seriously and such. And to like, you know, I think many of our problems in the modern day are what one gets when they sort of like have people hyper fixating on all the things that might be going wrong in their mental life. You know, so okay, maybe we want to sort of like a little bit of Stoicism, 5% more Stoicism. But I think a better way is not to like read the ancient Stoics, but it's just like to read modern people saying similar things. I mean, because the ancient Stoics had all sorts of bizarre views about like, I don't know, they thought that everything that happens is for the best.
I'm a bit skeptical of that claim.
I have an article on
the benefit of this is that there are some issues that a lot of this kind of like societal, I just call it human weather, this kind of societal censorship process leads to, yeah, like you said, like arguments that are dumb on their face. Like, I think a lot of kind of ancient numerology is sort of similar. And in fact, that there are kind of modern versions of the moralistic fallacy that will like read almost identically to numerology in due time.
No.
The kind of argument via offense that kind of goes pretty deep. And maybe you wouldn't call those people philosophers, which I guess would be correct. But, you know, at least are people who are trying to make ethical claims and have, you know, non-trivial prominence in the modern day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think there's much disagreement.
I have an article called Against History of Philosophy where I argue for this in more detail.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is that the storyline itself is compelling, right? Don't you think that's the case? That for a lot of people, the idea that, you know, Socrates has endured all these years and then there's people, you know, piling on and contributing their own takes on Socrates, you know, it's kind of like you see a tweet that's going viral. Many people have already registered their takes. Many people, you know, have registered their takes, including people who you respect. You know, like that play being played over a time scale of like millennia. That's like aesthetically pretty cool. Yeah, isn't it?
There might be something sort of aesthetically interesting about it. I don't know, like, you know, I don't mind people who just read like ancient philosophy, you know, because, you know, they find it interesting or they enjoy it. But the people who think that there's like a lot of deep wisdom to be gleaned from that Socrates had all these hidden insights that if we just internalized in the modern day, things would be much better. I basically think that position is not correct. Now, you know, if people want to read it for just sort of aesthetic reasons, for the same reason people read a lot of fiction, for instance, you know, that's fine. Like, you know, to each their own.
Yeah. Right. I don't know. It's pretty hard for me to argue against enjoyment. That's why I think, like, the literary philosophers kind of get right that, yeah, I don't know, I am kind of persuaded by this. Like I like Dostoevsky, I like the kind of not psychoanalysis as in like literal psychoanalysis, like the field of psychoanalysis, but like, you know, getting into these characters' heads as like a conduit of philosophy. I like this a lot. Although maybe it's not such a good thing to derive your understanding of the world from.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think of the kind of philosophizing through fiction?
I don't know. I mean, it's often fun to read, but I think it gives people a very distorted view, where it's just like fiction can convince you to believe anything. Like, you never root against the people who you're supposed to root for in fiction because they're made much more sympathetic. And so,
I'm like the opposite. Do you know about Madoka Magica?
No.
So Madoka Magica is a very intense character study told like entirely from the perspective of like, in my opinion, the archvillains, right? So there's this alien, and there's this alien cat who like comes to Earth and says like, we need to torture some girls, otherwise, like, the universe will end. Like, the exact mechanism of it is that, like, in the world of Madoka Magica, heightened emotional states create, like, alternate universes. And you can take the alternate universe, you can take the energy from the alternate universes and use them to, like, stop the heat death of the universe. And to me, like, this is the heat death of the universe we're talking about. Obviously, the alien cat is right. But that is not most people's conclusion.
Yeah. 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 Fiction that has a philosophical bent, you know, it can be compelling sometimes. But I do think that most of the time when people have really strong philosophical convictions based on reading work of fiction, I think those judgments are unreliable. Where it's like, your judgments are going to be most reliable if they're formed sort of coolly and dispassionately through rational analysis, which is not the case if you get it through reasoning fiction. Like, I think Le Guin, with her work, The Ones Who Walk Away from Amelis, has done a lot.
That is the main comparison to Madoka Magica that people keep throwing at me. But, go on.
Yeah, I think she is, decreased the quality of thought on the topic of utilitarianism.
Yeah. In which way? Do the like? This is very interesting to me because like, has she made like the utilitarians worse or like the anti-utilitarians worse, or both?
If her like the short story, it's really compelling. And if it were not so compelling, if it were not written so, you know, carefully and devastatingly,
wait, who is it compelling to?
Well, I think it's compelling to a lot of people. Just reading it, you know, I find it sort of emotionally compelling, even though I obviously, end up.
So, like, compelling to the anti-utilitarian position, right?
Yeah. But like if Le Guin just presented her like thought experiment in a sort of cool and dispassionate way, where she was like, utilitarianism has this weird implication that it would be okay to mistreat one person to a great degree to bring about pleasure if that was required for all of society to be happy, some people would be convinced by that, but they wouldn't have the sort of incorrigible convictions about it that they do as a result of Le Guin's piece of fiction.
Yeah. So what's interesting about the way I read fiction and the right way I write reviews of fiction is that this gives me like the opposite impulse, that, you know, the kind of strong emotional reaction and the like in-story emotional reaction of people just makes me think people of the position that you know Le Guin is implicitly endorsing are like more insane. Yeah, I sort of have like it's not quite the Richard Hanania thing. The Richard Hanania thing is like people who agree with him, he like grows to hate these people, right? But I see the like emotional mechanism at work, and I think like, oh, this is dumb.
Yeah.
But I think that you're right that more people need to have this reaction. More people. I don't know. To me, it's like seeing the rhetorical magic trick or whatever, and just being disgusted by the rhetorical magic trick.
Yeah. Right. I agree. Like, you know, if more people were like, you know, rational autists like you or I, you know, okay, you know, then, and you know, I use that as sort of like a not to mean people who are literally diagnosed with autism, but you know, like sort of like people who
I don't think it's rational for me. This pattern just makes me like emotionally hate them.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So you know, so,
yeah, so like I try like to overcome that, but that's the response for me.
They'll end up being sort of less distorting of a person's view. Maybe in your case, it like distorts it in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Right. Okay. What can we cover here? I don't know. I really like the anthropics. Maybe we can do some more anthropics. Do you know if there's any if there's any reason, is that why like they called it anthropic?
Yeah, I think so.
That like, that they're like they're reasoning gone. About like the existence of themselves or like of this AI that they're building.
Oh, I thought it was just like there are a lot of people in the Bay Area who think anthropics is cool.
Oh, I see. Also makes sense. Yeah, before I thought it was because like, oh, they're like anthropic, they're like pro humanity. But that maybe seems like less obvious from the way I've heard like their people use that term. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. We can just do the last question of the show if you want.
Sure.
And a bit early. Yeah, the last question of the show always is the last question of the show. What is one thing in the world that needs more chaos and one thing in the world that needs more order? Preferably things we have not talked about today.
Oh, okay. That's an interesting question. I feel like that's a question where to give a good answer, I'd have to think about it for a few minutes. But
sure. I mean, you can take your time. We have time, right?
Yeah. Well, so I guess things that need more chaos. Uh, I mean, okay, you know, I'm going to go out on a bit of a limb here. Maybe sort of like the scientific process. Like, it seems like going back many decades ago, science was more sort of chaotic and eclectic. And now it's just like people trying to get tenure and sort of like pumping out papers that are narrow and that they expect to get published. But I think we want more of the kind of like swing for the fences, potentially very high impact science that's sort of chaotic and eclectic. Other thing, people's blogs should be more chaotic and eclectic the way mine is. So, you know, just like write random articles about things rather than, you know, some of the article, like not edit very much and stuff. I think that would be a better world. In terms of things that should have more order, I mean, like the international system, you know, it seems pretty chaotic. That seems kind of bad. You know, you get a lot of wars and stuff.
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah, let's have fewer wars. That would be, I don't know, should we have fewer wars or more wars? One of the two. The current number of wars, not okay.
Yeah, I think we should probably have fewer wars, you know. Like, wars tend to be pretty bad.
That is a great way to end this very analytical philosophy chat.
That was my interview with Matt Adelstein. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, the best thing you can do is to let a friend know, either in person or online. It's the number one way to help us, and I'm sure that you're not only helping us, but you're helping a friend learn something new or find something entertaining, both of which are good. You can also help us out by subscribing to the podcast, leaving a 5-star review, and suggesting future guests. I read essentially all of the suggestions and reach out to very many, probably a vast majority of the guests that are recommended. They don't always get back to me, but such is life. You can also support the show financially on Substack. And if you do, you'll get a paid post-podcast episode where I myself reflect on some of the ideas we discussed. Either way, you'll get another one of these episodes every week on Monday. See you then.